Tom Patterson, thank you so much for your time today. And I want you to tell me why you decided to focus on How America Votes for your current line of work.
Well, Kurt, I have an interest in elections generally. I studied that in grad school, and that's been a kind of a constant part of my research over the 40 years that I've been, you know, a scholar. And I've looked at lots of different aspects of it. And one part is voter participation, not simply in terms of whether people show up on election day, but whether they get involved in the campaign, whether they're talking to friends and neighbors about the election, what they learn as a consequence of that. You know, we've had a long-term kind of participation problem in our elections. Once upon a time in the United States, we had turnout that was up in the 80 to 90% range. That's been quite some time ago. But there are democracies around the world that still have that level of turnout. We do reasonably well in presidential elections. A little more than 60% show up at the polls. Congressional elections, we don't even get a majority. And in too many local elections, you know, you get a turnout of 20%. And, you know, this is our opportunity, one of our opportunities to make a difference, to give direction to government. And, you know, we often complain that government isn't very responsive to us. But if we don't participate, it's kind of hard to have that expectation be a realistic one.
Who was it that said we get the government we deserve?
Well, I'm not quite it may be a little more toward the unfavorable side than we deserve. I do think, you know, there are a lot of things that are happening in politics today that I think have put distance between ordinary citizens and their elected officials. And one of those things that's in the middle is the money. Campaigns have gotten increasingly expensive, almost obscenely expensive for certain races, and that draws the candidates closer to the money people than to the people who actually vote. And of course, the interest groups that have a stake in and who wins and who loses in an election, they're increasingly powerful actors in our electoral process. And again, because they're organized, they're vocal, they're very visible to candidates and office holders. Sometimes our representatives are more responsive to the interest group than to the public at large. So, you know, there are a lot of things standing between us and officials. So to some degree, you know, the problem is ours as well as theirs, but we don't have complete control over it. And you know, and I do think officials, to some degree, get too caught up in their careers. The most important thing for them is getting back into office, and that means siding up to the people who can, you know, who can get them back in there. And to some degree, you know, we deserve better.
I'm a fan of Neil Postman and his work, particularly Amusing Ourselves to Death, which the subtitle's the best, Public Discourse in the Age of Show Business. And, you know, his main argument is that Aldous Huxley got it right based on, you know, Brave New World, and George Orwell got it wrong as forecast in 1984. Do you think Postman has a point that amusement and the focus of the media on issues that you know, really don't have that effect, that the show business idea, you know, results in kind of our mass distraction?
Well, I think Neil, that's a terrific book. I mean, it really is. And I think it is very descriptive of, to some degree, this playground, this entertainment playground that we now have. You know, there's so much media out there, and most of it is designed to divert us, to take us out of kind of the routines of daily life and transport us to someplace else, whether that's a movie, you know, a computer game or whatever. And we're very vulnerable to those alternatives. And I think to some degree, you know, the average American now spends about 7 hours a day with media. And for the most part, except in the work context, that is for entertainment purposes, you know, and I do think Neil also sort of caught the sense of, you know, when you're surrounded by this kind of media then the news as a piece of it, that piece of public affairs that's in the middle, seems kind of small and is less likely to catch our attention. And that's what we're seeing. We've seen, you know, declining audiences, particularly among young people, who many of whom, unlike previous generations, you know, weren't exposed a lot to a lot of news in the home as they were growing up, and therefore didn't acquire a news habit. And a lot of what we do is habitual, and so they spend less time with the news and a lot more time with entertainment. But even when you look at older groups, you see slippage in terms of their attention to the news. And I think a lot of that is there's so many choices. This is a high choice media environment. We love media, and increasingly we love the kind of media that was well described by Neil Postman in the context of amusing ourselves to death.
So do you think that political campaigns have in part become show business?
Well, they're serious business. There's a touch of show business, but they're very serious business. I think both sides in most races, and we do for the most part have a two-party system, they're intent on winning. I think more than being kind of in the show business category, I think they've taken us almost into the world of propaganda. I think we're very close to being on the edge of the spin now is so extraordinary in campaigns. The message distortion is so great that I think it's harder and harder now for an electorate to kind of work through all the competing messages and the confusion, often deliberate, that's created in campaigns to get a real firm sense of what their choices are. So I worry a little bit more that that our politics is kind of pushing into that message control to such an extent that in some ways we're kind of left to ourselves. I think the risk of not only amusing ourselves in the day-to-day things, but an election ending up deluding ourselves by the way we pick and choose and by the kind of the offer or the alternatives that are and the way they're presented to us. I mean, you know, an obvious example of that is the negative political advertising, which is now overwhelmingly the way that campaigns are conducted through television is with negative advertising. And, you know, at best, nearly every one of those is a half-truth. They leave out a lot of stuff. And unless we somehow know enough about the situation, we're at risk. If we take it literally, we probably are deluding ourselves about the choices that we face.
So what is the media's responsibility and role in an ever-increasing propaganda-style campaign?
Well, I think what you'd like the media to do is to somehow be the honest broker in these situations, to essentially be our advocate. And unfortunately, too often, I think the journalists get caught up in just covering the campaign, covering the horse race, and reporting what the candidates are saying, he said, she said, without distinguishing between the arguments. And The Atlantic's James Fallows talked and, you know, calls this the journalism of false equivalencies, that if you simply quote this candidate and quote that candidate and you don't kind of dig in and try to deconstruct what's happening, then you're opening the gates to where full truths, half truths, and sometimes outright lies have equal standing, and they get passed along to the public, and then we're left. We're forced on our own devices to try to sort this stuff out, and too often we don't have the information to do that. We don't have a deep enough understanding of some of these things, and journalists don't always understand them very well either. The way the system is supposed to operate is that the journalist is supposed to be our intermediary. They're supposed to help us understand, navigate some of these debates and discussions, and if they just let the debate hang in there raw, then we have trouble kind of understanding what's at stake. And I think this has always been a problem historically, but it's a bigger problem today. And the reason it's a bigger problem today is I do think in politics, and I don't think it has anything to do with the personal integrity of the candidates, but all the forces that are on politicians and candidates, I think there's less candor. I think there's less honesty. I don't think they're as straight with the American public. They're all out to win, and we've got a little bit of this kind of anything goes kind of mentality about. And then the PR industry, boy, is it extraordinary. Back in 1980, there were just as many journalists as there were people PR specialists. Today, there are four times as many PR specialists as there are journalists. And, you know, and what they're trying to do is put the best possible story forward for their client. But unless someone is kind of trying to really work at the edges of that story and kind of break it down a little bit and giving us a sense of what parts are more credible than other parts. And, you know, that's the journalist's job. And of course, many conscientious journalists do it and do it pretty well. But too often it's just kind of passed along to us. And I think that's a problem in our campaigns and in our politics generally.
I call that the professionalization of information. That's the phrase,
that's a good phrase I've
come up with, that because it seems like everyone, you're exactly right, everyone seems to have a public relations person representing them. Even campaigns now on the county and local levels, I'm encountering that there's a designated point person, not the candidate, that you have to go through or talk to first. That's an ongoing problem that I face as a reporter covering elections. And you talk about going around the edges to get at that, but then at a time when we do have this declining supply of reporters, of journalists, and the 24-hour news cycle and the competition online and everywhere else, how do we deal with that? What advice should you give to me if I called you on the phone and said, I've got this county commissioner who won't talk to me because I only get his spokesman?
Well, it is a problem, and there, you know, this wall that once was pretty small between the journalist and the official, it's gotten quite a bit larger. There's a lot more message control. You know, my sense of this is that American journalists, even more than European journalists, have been dependent on official sources. That's kind of grown up as the methodology. Most of the news comes from the top down, from, you know, hearing and talking with the top officials and the news originating there. I think journalists have to rethink what they mean when they talk about a source. By a source, they usually mean a newsmaker. If newsmakers are going to be less candid, if there's going to be more message control, then journalists have to have some counter-armament in order to be able to deal with that. And to me, that's a deeper understanding of the issues that are out there. The Washington Post's Walter Pincus said recently that he could not think of a single American journalist who really deeply understood education, despite how important education is to us. He said pretty much the same thing about food, you know, the food supply and all of the things that go into nutrition and the like. And he said about the only time that food gets into the news is when there's been an outbreak of food poisoning. You know, for journalists, I think the source increasingly has to be their understanding of the situation, that they have to get in and really try to deeply understand it and work from there rather than working from the words of individuals who have an agenda. And you're always going to have to listen to the newsmaker. They're an important part of the news, but in some ways kind of figuring out how to bridge that divide about what really is firm ground in this particular area, and then what you're being told is firm ground, and to help the public to navigate and get their feet back on the ground, as opposed to sometimes being, you know, 10 feet up in the air with a false sense of reality about what actually is there.
It seems to me that even places like PolitiFact and some of those things have these fact checkers, and especially during a national campaign, really get into that even those are more almost a he said, she said with a meter attached to it, rather than really getting at where you're talking about those edges.
You know, Kurt, I share pretty much that view, I think, of the fact checkers. We need people to be checking the facts. I mean, there's no question about that. And journalists need to be checking the facts. But if we're going to create a story or a big uproar around every kind of fudging of a small fact, then we're in a mess. We're in a place where we're in a swamp. You know, we have expectations about politics, and you know, every citizen knows that a politician is going to exaggerate. You know, and that's not a modern day phenomenon. That goes back about as old as politics itself. And I shouldn't quote a Soviet leader, but, you know, Nikita Khrushchev, I think, summarized it best. You know, every politician is going to promise you a bridge where there is no river. They're selling themselves, right? You know, but the thing is, that kind of stuff, you know, we figure that out. We take that with a grain of salt, and you start fact checking that. You know, then it just get confusion and noise in the system. But where we really need journalists to blow the whistle is around these large distortions that occur, and those are the points where you really need to jump in and say, "Now hold on a minute here," and. It's difficult for the journalist because, the journalist, if they confront a public official, guess what happens? They lose access.
Yeah.
Their access isn't very complete anyway, so they may not, in today's world, be losing all that much. But it's still the case that you have trouble getting access if you're known as someone who really kind of holds you, your feet to the fire every time you say something. So that's difficult for the journalist to do. And sometimes the journalist is in the position of not knowing the subject well enough. If you're going to call somebody out, you better know what you're talking about. You know, you're going to be, and you should be in trouble if you call someone out and then what's the problem here and you can't explain adequately what the problem is. And, and there is this thing about journalism, and to me it's one of the most interesting things about journalism as a profession. If you think about most professions, what defines the profession? You know, if you're a physician, it's because you're trained in medical science. If you're a lawyer, you're trained in a body of law. If you're an economist, you're trained in economic theory. Journalists are not trained in a body of knowledge. They're trained in the production of news. And so oftentimes with their sources, usually with their sources, they're in a situation unlike any other professional where the source knows more about the subject than they do, right? This is a real problem. During the first Persian Gulf War, in the Pentagon press office, which is where the journalists go to get information, they had a big sign, "Welcome temporary war experts." And the point was, we know war and you're here, you're going to pretend like you know war, but we're the real experts in this situation. So I do think journalists have to really think hard about how they get better equipped to understand these issues and use that much more as the foundation for the reporting than relying on what other people are saying is true.
You talked a little bit about what journalists need to do and how they're not really trained in a body of knowledge generally. But we also have this diversification of information and what some have called the democratization of publishing and then, video production. And due to the internet and social media, is this an antidote to some of these problems, or is this part of the problem, or is it a little bit of both?
Well, I think it's part of the problem if it's just about platforms, if it's just about doing the same thing through different mediums or doing the same thing through multi-mediums. To me, journalism is about content, not about platform. To get the story right, that's true for the print journalist as it is for the broadcast journalist or the web journalist or whatever. So that to me is the real key. We worked at my center at Harvard with 11 journalism schools around the country, backed by grants from the Knight Foundation and the Carnegie Corporation, to try to look at whether it made sense to think about embedding knowledge more fully in journalist training for journalism students, right? And how you think about that and how you might do that. So at one of the participating, and this is a six-year project, at one of the participating institutions, the way they approached it was instead of having the normal kind of news writing course where you go in and you learn story form and those kinds of things, that you had two people in the room. You had a journalism professor in the room, and then you had a subject matter expert in the room. And in the first year they did this, it was a national security expert, someone from the political science faculty, and it was team taught. All of the exercises that they did were reporting exercises. They didn't do kind of classic, subject matter exercises, right? So it was all reporting. But it was all reporting in this area of national security. And in every case, they were really deeply briefed about sort of what national security is like. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that course, and we kind of tried to test these a little bit, the students got it. And what they learned in it was they learned how to use knowledge. And even for the general assignment reporter, knowing how to use knowledge is an important thing. We think we can kind of just go to the web and pull something down, right? And when we do that, what do we do as a reporter? We just kind of tuck it in there as a nice sentence. Oh, isn't this a nice little morsel to enliven the story or make it look like we know more than we may do? That's not using knowledge. That's not knowing how to use knowledge. Knowledge really helps you to better understand a situation. And how do you get that better understanding? How do you make knowledge work for you? I think that's the real challenge. And a simpler example of that, I think, is you know, you can call it numerical literacy or statistical literacy or whatever. I think it's very hard to be a good reporter today without knowing how to interpret numbers. It doesn't mean you have to know how to generate the numbers, but you got to be able to interpret the numbers. And in most journalism programs, or I don't know if that's true, many journalism programs, that's probably a safer way to say it, there is no requirement. The journalism students have an understanding of number statistics and, you know, government records and the like, so they know how to – it's not just looking at the numbers, but how do you interpret them properly? And that's a skill that's acquired. That's a knowledge of how to use knowledge, right? And that's transferable across a lot of different situations.
Where do you put or how do you categorize the dilution of media in that someone with a blog might call themselves a journalist or might – you know, be reporting on an issue or a consider themselves an expert in covering an area without some of that training and that education. Yeah. Kind of what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think that is a dilemma for dedicated journalists, and I've kind of thrown up my hands on that one in a sense. I mean, this good debate goes back. I mean, I'm at this Press Politics Center at Harvard, and we have journalists come through there weekly and people are in other areas of communication and the like. And so we talk a lot about these things. And I remember, you know, when talk shows started and is Larry King a journalist? Right? Well, he's putting out public information. He's talking to newsmakers. What's the difference between what Larry King is doing and what happens on those Sunday morning interview programs? I mean, is there a distinction between a Larry King and a Russert or someone like that? And it's almost like how many angels dance on the head of a pin, right? I think what's the problem is when the public gets confused about these things. If you get confused about source, then you become indiscriminate about the information that's coming from those sources. And, you know, I think everybody knows there's a lot of sources of misinformation out there today that some people think are, in fact, giving them the straight truth. And one of the things that you see that's happening when you track public opinion is rising levels of misinformation in this country around just about every issue that's out there. And a classic example of that, of course, is the death panel's allegation that that this health care reform bill, when it was working its way through Congress in 2009, 2010, included a death panel's provision where there would be a commission as you reach the end of your life that would make the decision of whether you were going to be entitled to any more medical care or not. There never was a provision like that in that bill. There is no provision in the law that came out of Congress. At one point, 50% of Americans thought there was such a provision in the legislation. Even today, probably 20% think so. Where did that start? That started on talk radio and ricocheted from one talk radio show to the other. Then it kind of filtered its way into the mainstream press as a controversy. And it got embedded in some people's heads that this is reality. And it was very far removed from reality. And it's really hard to have meaningful, productive public debate and discourse when you have large numbers of people looking at the world and thinking it is in a certain form and it's not anywhere near that form. That's a complete block to making progress in these debates about our issues.
And are you afraid that to a certain extent that for a voter, when you're faced with this misinformation and you have these competing sources, that one of the responses is to just stay home?
Well, that can happen. What's interesting is it kind of works a little bit the other way on some level. This is one of the interesting things about our understanding of politics, where we actually are a little more inclined to vote if we hate the other side, right? Mm. And a lot of the misinformation is put out by people who are trying to get us agitated, get us worked up. They're not trying to inform us. They're trying to motivate us. And so ironically, it can work the other way, or it tends to work in a way that keeps people from voting is when you get moderate people who are of a moderate tendency who really aren't kind of true believers in one party or the other. And for them, then it has a depressing effect. And it's one of the reasons why even if you kind of have the same level of turnout, you're actually changing the composition of your electorate. You're getting more and more people who are from the extremes, the real activists, the people who are truly energized, and you squeeze out some of your moderates. And, of course, we have a problem of polarization generally in our politics, and that just compounds it.
Another issue that I've thought might be contributing to some of this is the way that redistricting happens now, that the information that the folks drawing those lines have is so detailed. There's so much data that, you know, you can draw a line that really can protect an incumbent of one party or the other for a significant period of time, unless, of course, that neighborhood changes, that area changes, and that always can happen. And so then we have these concerns that, once again, are we redistricting for the extremes, I guess I might ask?
I think that's an important question, and I think there's some confusion about that. I mean, look, there's no question with computers and the amount of data that we have today that you can draw these boundaries in more exact ways, that you can basically kind of squeeze out every possible vote. But even 50 years ago, we had a lot of data and a little bit of arithmetic and playing around with the boundaries to get you pretty close to something that was pretty close to being maximized. So, you know, yeah, they've gotten better at it, but it's been going on for a long time. And the very term gerrymandering goes back to the colonial period. So, you know, drawing districts in favorable ways is nothing new. I think the real key here, though, and why gerrymandering and these district boundaries matter more is because there's another piece of it. And this other piece is that spatially, physically, we're dividing. So we've always had Republicans and Democrats, but increasingly parts of the country are getting more and more concentrated in terms of being Republican bastions or Democratic bastions. You know, the Northeast at one time, by some standards, was slightly Republican, but for sure it was really closely competitive between the parties. Today, it's very strongly Democratic, right? So when you draw the boundaries now in the Northeast for most districts, and you could, even if you did it under the old system, you're going to end up with mostly lopsided districts because you don't have enough Republicans to have enough competitive districts. You look at many parts of the South, you got the same situation. You get into Oklahoma and this particular area, same thing. You know, as the states have kind of sorted themselves out, and as areas of the country, rural, urban, have moved increasingly toward the blue or the red, between one party or the other. And then what happens? Well, then when the districts get lopsided, kind of just naturally, and then you draw the boundaries to make them even a little more lopsided, well, we know who's going to win the House seat from that particular district. That's never been in question. So it's just a question of which member of the party that's going to win that is going to get it. Then we get to the primary electorate and who shows up for primary elections. Mm-hmm. You know, and this often is 15 or 20% of the electorate, and disproportionately it's the people who have extreme views, whether you're talking about the Democrats and the liberal wing, the Republicans and the conservative wing, and that pushes our politics toward the extremes, not only because in a really competitive primary like that, the one that is more far right or far left is likely to win, but even if the more moderate of the two candidates wins, what are they worried about? Mm-hmm. They're not worried about the candidate from the other party. They're worried in the next election that someone's going to come in who's a little further to the extreme than they are. And we saw that with the with the government shutdown. There was never a majority in the Republican caucus for shutting down the government. But there was a really hardcore group that was determined to do it. And then there were a number of other Republicans enough so they had a majority in the caucus who understood if they came out publicly in a different position, they were going to face a real challenge from the right in their party. And so between the two, those that were the true believers and those that were the fearful, you had a majority in the Republican caucus. And that was really what held up cutting a deal. And you didn't get a deal basically until it was pretty clear from the polls that this was costing the Republican Party generally a pretty substantial amount of support. You have a similar phenomenon. It's not quite as exaggerated because the Democrats don't have the equivalent of the Tea Party, so they're less well organized, I think, on the left. But you know, many of these Democrats, more moderate Democrats that are from these lopsided Democratic districts, they're not worried about losing to a Republican. They're worried about losing a primary to another Democrat.
Where do you find hope in your work and what you're seeing? What are those glimmers of light out there that make you keep at this?
Oh, I Kurt, you probably sell more books by peddling doom and gloom, you know. I'm a real optimist. I think about the United States, about the American people. I think there's a lot of good sense here, and this is a very diverse society, and you can realize why there's all sorts of tensions and why politics matters to many people, but. We've been at this for 200 years, and we've had our low points. I think we are at a low point right now. We kind of figure out how to sort this through. And my guess is that not going to be a short-term fix. I don't see anything in the immediate future that is going to improve things. I think this polarization is pretty deep, and some of the forces that are contributing to it are pretty powerful. But I do think kind of in the end, we kind of figure these things out, how to make this American experience and the experiment of our democracy a continuing and productive one. So I just think that kind of that national sense about what we are as a people and what we need to do collectively ultimately prevails. And I wish I had some kind of magic formula to give it a boost, some kind of rocket booster or something, a second stage boost or something. I don't have one of those. I do think if we could deal a little bit with the money problem in politics, I think that would hasten the day where we kind of get back to a little bit more politics of moderation and where people really start working together more effectively. I do wish we had kind of more sensible, some states, do pretty sensible redistricting where the goal at the beginning is to how many competitive districts can we create as opposed to how many uncompetitive districts can we create. So I do think there are some procedural things that could help. They're difficult to get through, as you know, because the people in power are the ones who make decisions about what the process is going to look like. And if they benefit from the current rules, they're not going to change the rules, or at least not change them very easily. So I think we do know some things that would help, but they're not easy to get.
Tom Patterson, thank you so much for coming in and your time today.
Kurt, my pleasure. Thank you.